What is up, Hockey IQ listeners? I'm here to chat about our newest sponsor, Sensarena. Your brain is one of the most important parts of your body. Why not invest in a tool that allows you to train it? With Sensarena, athletes can gain a competitive edge using VR training. Players are able to go through a scenario thousands of times without having to step foot on the ice. No more waiting around for puck touches or perfect scenarios. Sensarena can enhance reaction time, decision-making, and multitasking abilities, making you the next MVP. I mean, if the LA Kings are using it, it's got to be good. With our promo code HockeyIQ, you receive $50 off an annual plan purchase. Head on over to Sensarena.com to check it all out.
On the Hockey IQ podcast today, we bring on John, in parentheses, the Colombian, Castrillon. Super excited to have you on, John. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for opening the door and welcoming me on this side.
Yeah, this is an exciting one. Wally Kozak has been just singing your praises for so many months, and it feels like years and decades at this point, even though I haven't known Wally that long. But I know you have an interesting story. Obviously, you moved to Canada in 1975, just wanted to learn some English better, but somehow ended up in Montreal. So now you've got, French, English, you mentioned Spanish is your native tongue.
A little bit of Portuguese. And I can say after three tequilas, I can speak Italian quite good.
Love it. But you've been in Canada for a really long time. It wasn't just a temporary move. It ended up resulting in you residing in Montreal, Calgary, and now Vancouver, and just observing and understanding hockey from a very unique perspective and toying around with ideas that came from soccer in Colombia, and more so just from observing the game. Everyone I talk to about you says you're a very observant person to ask questions and push the boundaries there. So I'd love to just dive into the power of observation, because coaching skills, and I call it the skills of teaching, the skills of coaching, are inherent, and some people think about them, but a lot of people don't. But I really want to dive into those specific skills. Like, you've got self-reflection, you've got demonstration, explanation, all of this. But I think that the most important one is just observing well. So for you, as someone who came into hockey later in life, didn't come from a hockey nation originally, like, you know, one, maybe what is the moment that got you into hockey? And then two, how did you approach observing the sport? And then what did you notice as you were observing?
Well, like I say, my first experience was in when I came in October 9, 1975, Montreal, Boston, first game. And I asked my dad, what is that? And he said, oh, this is ice hockey. And I was captivated by the sport. So that was the first time I saw it. And then somehow I say, well, maybe I should play this. And I started asking myself, how am I going to do that? And that's what I think my thirst for observation became. And because I started going to the rink, and somehow I was sitting down observing, and I don't know what level I was watching, but some of the kids were not very good. They couldn't skate really good. And some of the other kids were really good. So I was sitting down, you know, the rat drink, I guess that's the word, watching for a week, I don't know, for time. And I'm like, okay, what I have to do here to learn to play hockey? What is the common denominator here that I need to achieve? And I say, oh, if I learn to skate good, I think I'm going to do good. Because more I saw these guys going on the ice with speed and elegance, I would say, a good skater, then I think that's when I started observing and be more attentive to details. But I was young, 16 years old, 16, and but I think that's what's the moment where I had to, I had no choice. I knew one thing. If I wanted to play, I need to skate good. And the only way to skate good was to observe how people do things. At the time, it was no power skating schools. It was very unknown, I think. It was nothing like that. Like now, we have all these and schools and academies and all that. And for me, it was like, wow, how am I going to do this? So I have to taught myself, yet I have to observe other people, how they were doing things. And that's what I think the curiosity of observation came alive with me. So.
So, skating's number one. What else were some things that you picked up? Was there certain details about skating that helped you pick up skating itself? Because obviously it's not a natural movement. I mean, you try walking on the ice, you're not going to be going very far very fast.
Well, that's an interesting question. If we go forward, I will tell you what I saw, how I broke it down, the dynamic of the movements and all that. But at the time, I have no idea. So I got into the ice and I started skating. It was horrible. I was an ankle skater. I mean, my skates were, by the way, I went to buy skates, and because I was sort of, I feel some sort of shame because I didn't know. And I at the store, I said, I picked the first skate I saw, the cheapest one, $15. And they were like, the ankles were like paper, Bauer skates. I still remember Bauer skates. And I told my dad, no, they're good. They're good. Don't worry about it. And I think I picked, instead of 8.5, I picked 9. So they were really loose. And I still remember when I put them on, my ankles turned inside. And that didn't help, right? So, but I didn't know, right? So it's hard for me to, I think I went through the process of more try and failure and trying to discover what happened. Hey, first time I sharp my skates, I told my dad I have to sharp my skates. So I get this big, how do you call that in English? That big metal,
The
come on.
runner edges, yeah,
Yeah,
steel,
well,
something like that.
yeah, they were long, and my dad had one at home, and where we were living, I said I took that and I start shaping my skates, everywhere, and I'm like, good, now I'm ready. I went on the ice and I almost killed myself because I took completely, and people were laughing, and I'm like, I don't know, I shot my skate yesterday, I don't know what is going on. So somebody told me, John, you're dumb. You got to go to a shoe shop and they have a machine. And I'm like, what? Okay. So I went 20, 25 cents, by the way, Greg, 25 cents I paid. And I saw for the first time a sharpie machine. And then I said, oh, then again, I went back on the ice and I almost killed myself because now the skates were too sharp. And so it's all these experiences. And I think my journey learning was, like you say, I had nobody to teach me. I had no one. And it's, nobody came to me and said, hey, we're going to teach you. No, nothing. I just have to go and try and try. And then, like I said, I buy this book, Howie Meeker. He got a book on skating and Jacques Lemaire. And, after 6 months, I bought those books and I started reading them. And I said, okay, how I can improve my skating? And then, I started working. I was doing a little bit better. Then I went to buy another pair of skates. And I say to my dad, I think I want to buy this. Super tax CCM at the time. So $50, I still remember. I told my dad, I want to go help you at your job and I can make some money. And I bought the skates. And they were leather skates. I don't know if you remember or if you remember them. CCM tax. They were leather and beautiful. And I saw these guys skating out there like, oh my God. So if I buy those skates, maybe I will skate like him. And then, I basically ask at the store that time, what is the best sort of fit for my foot, and they explained to me a little bit, and then I think I have better skates and fit that fit me properly, and then I think I start improving really, really, because I spend, Greg, believe it or not, I spend 10 to 15 hours a day for I don't know how many months on the ice skating. Because I had access to a place in Westmont in Montreal, and it was a private rink. And because I went to the school close there, and I could learn French so fast, the teacher said, go skate, do something else, because you're wasting your time here and waiting for everybody else. So I went 8 o'clock in the morning, and they will kick me out sometimes at 11:30 because that was when they closed the ice. And I spent all that time skating, refining. Now, I took a movement, whatever, turn left or a crossover, so stopping from the left side. And I start, you know, the repetition, the what do you call the rotten repetition model that I, you know, we can talk about this another day maybe, but it's, you know, the academia and the new sort of, you know, ecological dynamics and, you know,
Yeah, and I really love the piece that you just kind of like walked us through, which is like the personal self-discovery of skating sport. Like, I think that's a powerful thing to think about because that used to be a massive piece, especially up in Canada. Like, everything freezes over, you go skate, go play with your buddies, and you just discover the game naturally through your own lens and through a very personalized way. Feels like now you sometimes get it
You
where
can.
it's so organized where we lose that step of like the players are constantly looking to the authority figures, whatever that may be, like what should I do here? When should I do this? And they lose that piece of control almost, or what's the best way to put it? Like
Freedom.
that
It's a
locus, yeah,
freedom.
freedom and locus of control of internally, yeah.
I think you know what you got. You nailed it because I think if I wouldn't come in 2000 something, I would have never learned hockey because that. At that time, I had nobody to tell me you're doing wrong, you suck, you're not going to learn hockey. One guy told me, "Well, you why you want to play hockey? You're 15 years old. You never do it." And I say, I still remember that guy, and he was another Latino guy. I say, "Oh, he's going to waste your time." I say, "No, I want to learn." So that, what you say, basically, I had nobody. I had all the time, and I had nobody to criticize me or say, "Hey, you're not going to learn." And I trust me, Greg, I went home some days with my elbows, my ass, my knees. I could barely walk. And my dad is like, "Yo, what are you doing?" But yet, when I started feeling the first acquisition of movements, and I started feeling at easy on the ice, it went crazy. I went harder, and I increased the tempo of detail training. And I had the books already, by the way. And then I started really paying attention to that. And then I keep going to rinks, or when I was skating, I was observing the guys skating, people who were very good. You know, you got some athletes who go there and skate, and I'm like, "Oh, I'm gonna try to do that." Backwards, how you skate backwards? Well, you gotta start doing it, and then how you implement all these edges work, and you know, inside, outside. Remember, we all have a strength to one side. For me, it was a total discovery. I had no idea, but then I put two and two. I say, well, I play with my right foot in soccer and I don't use my left foot. So hockey skating is not so different. I can turn left so good, but every time I try to turn right, I fail. Every time I go and kill myself. What is that? So again, I more I search and you know, and they say it in the book is yeah, you got to be able to do both sides. Crossovers. Greg, what is your strength? And usually you will say 90% of people go left side, strength. Go right. Yeah, I'll do it. And you know, good skaters will look at easy, but if you pay attention with diligence, everybody is strong on one side more than the other side. Unless you dedicate an immense amount of work as a pro to become proficient at both. And that's very hard to find. Remember at the time in the NHL, few players could play both hands, right or left, and they could switch with their sticks. They had this stick with the blade that was straight. And I remember who was the guy, Bernardo Frion, I think, or a few other guys out there who could play both sides, shoot both sides. But how many guys do that nowadays? And at easy, I mean, I'm saying you get some maybe guys doing some, but not with efficiency or the same way. So ambidextrous, how many players can play soccer, left foot, right foot, like magical?
Yeah,
Name it.
it's actually really fun. I love to do games where players switch sticks. So if you're a righty, you give it to a lefty, and a lefty give it to a righty. Because you know, one, there's the preference of like the turning what they're normally used to, and this is, you know, you're not going towards like your forehand, but there's a lot of like little details you don't think of, like, oh, who actually protects the puck well and like values that versus those that are like, I'm just gonna dash it away. And I think there's some good learning opportunities within there and within that struggle. And the second piece that I really wanted to key on what you talked about here was like just experimenting and messing around. And then players do it, but I feel like coaches are a little less like they just don't want to do it as much because it's uncomfortable and it exposes them, especially as like kids. You're not really too worried about exposing yourself, right? You're learning, trying, and failing constantly. But as adults, now it's like, oh, it's embarrassing. People are watching me, they're judging me, whatever it is. And I think we need to get back to allowing ourselves as coaches and, people allowing coaches to explore and experiment and test around, because I think there's a lot of good learning for not just the coach, but for the players from that experimenting and messing around. I know you've done a ton of that in your days.
Oh yeah, I think you say it. I mean, this is the new model of learning. I think is allowing that exploration to happen, freedom of discovery, I would say, to explore those possible futures that the game offer every time, at every moment. So when we coaches allow ourselves to start experimenting, I think we open that door for progress and I always say beauty, because I what I have experimented over the years now is beauty. It's fantastically great. It goes out of the book, out of what do we say, the traditional way of coaching, the normality of coaching, that sort of line that everybody's following. We were talking with Dean the other day in a beautiful article from this guy from Spain. He say, I'm tired. I go anywhere and I see the same stuff everywhere. It's that formality of training mentality that have sort of take a space in coaching. In hockey, hey, trust me, Greg, I observe. For the last 20 years, I was at the Oval, not the Oval, first at the Oval, and then David Bauer. And then when they created the COP, I don't know if you heard about the COP in Calgary. It's like four rings. It's where the Canadian teams do their training. And trust me, I was there for every national team training, women's, men's, boys, 17. And I seen Japanese teams, French team, Russian team, everything that came there. And when I heard that guy the other day, I said, yeah, well, I read what he wrote. It's, yeah, everybody's doing the same stuff. Everybody's doing the same stuff. And so I think you're absolutely right. If the kids can do that, we should be able to do it. And the other part is, if you're not able to do it, get somebody who can do it, especially demoing. What do we say? When you do demos, if you're a good skater, you're good. If you're not, be careful, because that's when the hammer will come down or the axe will come down. And soccer, I always say, if you're going to demo something, then do it good. If not, then get somebody. Get Messi, get, I don't know, Cristiano Ronaldo, get them flying to your training session and
They might
shut
be
up.
a busy making a few billion dollars or so right now.
Come on, you have a, Greg, I heard you have a good budget. Come on, let's go.
Yeah, but no, I think that's a great point you make. It's like with coaches, sometimes we feel like we have to demonstrate, but a lot of times it's
No,
like,
we don't have to.
why can't we have a player do it? I love asking, like, all right, we're gonna work on Mohawks. Who knows what that means? And two kids put their hands up, like, all right, can you show us? At least one of them's super excited to show off, like, oh, I could totally do this. Like, you don't have to be the person doing it as a coach. Like, you can just find ways to involve the players. It's a lot of fun, and just mess around and experiment and test of understanding using all of these coaching skills we're talking about. I'm curious for you. I know you observed a lot and you explored and you're taking a lot from soccer. You've got a big approach in your main methodology, as I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is around creating games and finding ways to teach skills and tactics through small-sided games. I'm curious what that currently looks like for you.
Well, the genesis of this come from, I mean, started in the 1980s, later, 80s university, and I started searching for that. The principle of teaching game for understanding is, or sorry, how you use games to teach the game. And it's so much we can talk about here, but I think to make it like trying to explain it, how you use games, a constraint-lead approach, using the constraint-lead approach where you put certain constraints so the players can start dealing with the game. So for me, has been a quest. The first one was with my kids. So I say, do we need to create that? Yes, they need to play the game. They need to discover the game. So my first quest was, okay, what is the simplest stuff they can do? Play, play. And then we go to numbers and spaces and scaling the model of the game so it fits my young players, my youth players. That was for me the challenge. Because I debated that 11-11 at U12. I say, we're crazy. You're crazy. 5-5 in hockey at U10, at U8. You're crazy. What is wrong with us? Sorry, Greg. And I based this observation, and somebody, hey, people can call me after if they want, and we can debate this. If they're not happy, they can buy the tequila and I go for another long conversation. But I will tell you one thing. After 40 years, I give me some authority, I will say, to debate that. Because I saw it with my kids. And I say, I never, in hockey, by the way, my kids never play organized hockey until nine. I cut it out. I say, I'm going to do it. If I'm wrong, time will tell. But I wasn't. They never play organized hockey until nine. Never. I didn't care about this or that or the other. Or in soccer, neither in soccer until nine. 10, they went to their first novice or, U10 sort of games. And I was controlling that. I was coaching. And then I applied that principle of game every time. So I do divide games and preparation movement that I call. I want to specify preparation movement is learning movement, skating or walking or running or agility coordination. That's what I want to make the difference. Skill acquisition is based on game, in games. That's when you learn to play the game. And so for me, it was two different things at the time. I didn't know all what I know now, but I think I was already touching those things already. So I started doing that. So games were critical for my kids to learn. So they play a lot of 3-on-3, 2-on-2, 1-on-1. And we went from there. I never changed it. And we always play, if we play 1 hour and a half, the last 30, 40 minutes were always a game, a tournament. I designed the tournament and they knew. We never changed that model. And until nowadays, I'm still doing it. People say, wow, but you need to do more. I say, no, I don't need to. I need to do 1-on-1 that I believe is critical for what we do. And the 2-on-1s, 2-on-2. I mean, it's a matrix that you need to sort of respect somewhere. But that's what games brought me into it. And I went from out from the drill because I never liked a drill when I played, Greg. I'll be honest. I hate it. Patterns. I say, why do I have to pass to that guy out there and go there? When I play Messi, it doesn't matter where I go. I'm going to have to stop him, and I'm not ready for this because he's not a pylon. He moves, and he's very good. And it doesn't work what I do. What else I need to do, coach? Well, and that was one of the questions I had when I started playing hockey. I say, I need to play shinny hockey. That was my other observation. I say, I have to go play shinny hockey as much as I can. Or with adults, with younger, it doesn't matter. Just play, play, play. Because that's how I learn in Colombia, in the street. And you play, play. Now, you play in the street, you don't play U10s. You play sometimes 16 years old, they're going to kick you hard. And you're going to be bleeding sometimes. And that's the way you learn. Okay, how you avoid that guy? How you don't get close to him and make a nice pass? Or how you dribble him to the legs and he's going to get really mad and he's going to come after you. But you see, when we start talking about these affordances, or when we start talking about all these dynamics, we start, I think, realizing that we need to do something really different. I don't know. For me, it was a quest. And games were the part that I wanted to really focus on and how to transmit that to my kids. So first.
I love that saying, like games to teach the game, like using games as a way to teach the game. And it's a, and like you mentioned, it's a hell of a lot more fun. Like you get kids that want to come back to the rink, and you know, we always talk on, you know, many different levels. Everyone's talking about like the best of the best kids. And it's like, well, that's great, but let's also talk about the lower end. Like we're just trying to keep them in the game because there's so many good life skills and creating good citizens that we can do. And then even for the top end kids, like for the most part, their technical stuff is good enough. Like they need to understand the tactile point of it. So that's super important. And then the last piece that I wanted to highlight, what you just said, was like the importance of going outside of your age band. Like instead of playing U10s, like playing with kids that are 16 or maybe having kids that are younger than you.
Oh my
And
God.
there's so many
Great.
advantages between
Great.
going through those groups. Like I play adult league now, and you know, we'll do some pickups, and there's some really talented young kids. They got
Yes, and then
better skating skills, technical stuff than all of us old guys. And then they go and lose 10-2. Like it's not rocket science. It's not a lack of
No,
technique
I
and
know.
technical skills. You know, there's
So
some tactical pieces here.
I give you an example of what I've done for I did it for almost 10 years in Calgary. So I call it the Spartan Fridays. And I created this sort of made, so I'll explain it. And so every Friday we'll play for 2 hours, 4 to 6. And I develop games, so now I call them I have different name for every game I call. And this one is called a vortex. A vortex is three fields that are together and interact between each other. That's what I call a smart transitional games. And it's a concept that I've been working on for the last, I would say, 25, 30 years. And those games are an evolution of what I started with, the simplicity of things, right? And then my question was, so how it can evolve from a sort of generation one games where I am now on generation five games. And all these generation are domains of how we play the game. So I designed these games, and guess what? U12, U13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 come. And we play a tournament, 3 and 3. Greg, you play with John, who is 12 years old, and Junior, who is 32 and play professional in Germany. Jordan, you're playing with Rebecca and with whoever. You never know who you're going to play with. We'll make the teams. We'll make sure they're balanced. One captain is an adult or an older player. A lot of the players I coached in Calgary in the first year when I got there, I got into an academy and the Select program, the Alberta program. They came to me. Believe it or not, at 35, they're still coming to these Fridays. John, when you start? October, good, we'll be there. And they will embrace it so hard. They will play with a U12 and a girl, and that's a team for that day. So the winner takes all. They go to Hawaii on the weekend, and the rest do 20 push-ups or whatever. So it was so magical to see sometimes the games going in three fields, 3 and 3, 3 and 3, 3 and 3 at the same time. That's three fields, that's three games, and we have more teams. So I had a system for that. Greg, I never seen people so happy. One of the kids told me this, and I will tell you, I won't name no teams, no names. They told me not to come to your place on Fridays. And you know what he told the club where he was playing in? Say, and we're talking about a kid who's almost at the door of the national team. You know what he told the club? Say, that's my free day, I can do whatever I want, and this is the best day of my week.
Oh, the
And
best day of his week. I love hearing that.
for me, it was a compliment. Like I say, come on. You say, John, this is the best. I come here because I love it, because I enjoy myself so much. And we're talking a kid who's at the highest level, playing with U12 for a girl or two girls. Because sometimes I push him, I say, hey, deal with it. What are you going to do? And he got it. He's like, hey, I got this, John. Don't worry about it. Got the girls. And I love it because the girls, the kids, I mean, Jordan, my son, is an amazing player. And he play in those. So they will get their team, and you should see the interaction. the connectivity between the players, and the kids loving it too. Honestly, I say if we can recreate that, Greg, we are doing a magnificent job, I think. And we're achieving everything that we're looking for. The rest, it matters? No. Who won? No. They don't care. They like to win, but they're when they go out sweating and smiling and say, okay, I'll see you next week, it's the best compliment you can have.
Yeah, and then just figuring out what do they need to work and be adaptable. I feel like that is one of the things that gets overlooked massively. Is a big changer between being able to go highest levels.
And you know what I told my kids? It's a rule. We call it the no mercy rule. Greg, don't be nice. You have the ball. I don't care. Don't give it to anyone. My kids are like, they told the kids, the U12, you want the ball, come in and get it. You're not gonna get anything for free here. So when you set up that standard, and one day one of my girls, Meg, my son Junior, Greg, you know how her smile was for a week? She said, I met Junior. And Junior said, she made me. I never saw it coming that. And she was the most happiest kid out there. So they have to earn everything too. Greg, we got to be careful with this. And that's another topic of talking, that sometimes we set up things, we design things, but we don't have a deep purpose in what we're doing. And I think we got to be very careful, not only designing, but how we implement these things and how we manipulate them and how we put that spice out there. And it's like cooking, my friend. You got to be an artist. You got to be crafty at what you do. So, yeah, over the years, I think you do that. And that's what I love. Yeah, keep doing it. That's what I love it.
That's beautiful. I love that no mercy rule. That's something that with a wide ranging of abilities can sometimes be overlooked because now you start practicing it and it seeps into your habits. And then the other side of it is like there's unrealistic game for everyone else. So that no mercy rule is something. I'm going to steal that and I'm going to talk with my team on that because I feel like sometimes we're a little
Well,
too nice to each other.
Greg, I think we have this. I mean, how society is going now, and I don't know. Oh, I gotta send you this. I'll send it you later. A mom in the MLS complaining that Messi is too good and his son is not feeling is going to be like going to in depression because Messi is there playing. Come on, give me a break. Really? Really? So,
Please do send
and
that.
again, so I'll send it to you. I don't know if you read about it, but I'll send it to you. But the point is, I told the kids, and they go there knowing that they may not touch the ball. They will, because they're playing with good players too. And they will get the ball. But I told them, I said, listen, you want to improve, push yourself. And usually the people who came to my staff, they were pretty aware of that. And I tell you, some of the U10s, U12 who came to me after 1 year, you'll be amazed how they play. It's like, oh, now they're head up. I mean, I have all these principles that we talk about. It's pretty strict. And when you get a score, hey, you got to run out. By the way, for all the hockey guys who are going to listen to this, I cannot figure out how you run on ice, because hockey players walk on ice every time when they do drills, and they just cruise so beautiful. So I haven't figured out yet how I can measure running in hockey, because my players in soccer, my tempo is running. You go water, you run. You come back, you run. You finish something, you run. You collect something, you run. I see you walking, 10 push-ups, everyone. In hockey, I haven't figured out, Greg. Help me on this, because I don't know. I
So
tell the players, go.
that's a tough one because like even in the NHL you watch the game like most players are
Oh
going
my
about
God.
75% and then there's like the switch that turns on and you're constantly worrying about speed differentials and probably something to do with the skates and how you're locked in on your edges. I'm not quite sure on that one. That's a tough one.
I will tell you one thing. Over the years, my observation is this simple. We're not pushing them hard enough, and they're not disciplined enough. I mean, remember, my son is now a special op guy, and we talk a lot. He's at the top of the performance world. If you want to talk performance, that's the top. It's not the NHL. It's not The world, no, these guys are okay, and we can talk about this, and we know. I say this in a very humble way. People think they work hard, but they don't. I'm sorry. What I seen and what I talk with my son, yeah, they have no idea what to work hard is. And you've seen it. Everybody can see it. Go see the Navy SEALs Hell Week. And by the way, our boys go for 10 days, not 5 days. So who's tougher?
Ah, there we go.
So, but the point is, and like you say, where that come from? And by the way, I coach hockey. I've been doing it for the last 40 years too. I've been involved, mentor, and everything. And Dean, I say Dean, how we made this guy run on ice? Tell me, please, because something shut down every time when the players are active on training. If you look, Greg, pretty careful. They go hard for a little bit. Even inside that drill, they shut down too. And they, if you observe properly, they cruise every time and they're done. So my question again, how I transform that and make them compete to the end? Because when is their real time of competition for a hockey player? When, Greg? When they play.
Yeah, when they're playing.
Yeah, and the NHL, you know what I might say? Might give it to you. Hockey players at the NHL level only train hard for 82 times of the year when they play. Because I have observed so many NHL practices over the last 30 years, an immense amount of training sessions. And that's my thing. They're good athletes, and don't get me wrong, they're super athletes. They do this, that. But they go from two modes, one at the game time, and they lower that level at the training time. What is the excuse? You can have excuses. You can have, we can debate this. People say, oh, they travel too much. They do this. They cannot train hard every time. Go talk to Tarasov, Greg. You know what he
I
used
don't
to
think we
do? You
can
know that.
anymore.
No, but you know what he used to do, Tarasov? He will play the final of the gold medal on the World Cup championships at 4 p.m. and they were training 9 to 11 as hard as they could go before that. So you tell me, yeah, you say that. And I understand, yeah. But again, that's it's another topic, I guess, but
Yeah, so these are all
good.
great things that go into coaching. I'm curious, you mentioned about mentoring coaches. So like, what are the things that you're mentoring them most on? What are some of the common threads and themes that whether they're struggling with or that you're talking and having conversations with them on?
So I will give you a feedback of one of my last coaching clinics that I did for Alberta Soccer. And you know, we talk about Dean, and we've done it in hockey too for an association, Bow River. We did it for 5 years, 4 or 5 years. I will tell the coaches this every time. The first thing you need to do is to connect to players, is to feel that energy. That's my personal feeling too, is when I go talk to coaches, I need to feel that connection first. When you have passion and you have that fire in and you go with passion into it, I think you open a door for more room for the coaches to understand what you're trying to transmit to them. And that's the power, I think, of connectivity, I call, of transmitting that passion first than anything. Not my knowledge. Don't talk about hockey or anything or tactics. No. Let's go talk about how we feel as coaches and how much power we have out there and how we can connect to the players and do that. So usually I get the coaches being players out there. I say, you know, the first thing I do every time, right? We line up our bags. We line up our bags. The coaches always laugh and say, what? Hey, your bags, they're, look at your bags. Say, what? They're a mess. So I say, you got 10 seconds. You run and fix them. So usually they fix them really bad. So I want perfection. So they have to go back again. And then one of the coaches always say, hey, my God, I never thought about this. I say, well, think about it. You go to a training session in soccer, hockey is different. But in soccer, and you have the water bottles all over the place and the bags all over the place. And I say, that's for me, this the base of starting to create something as discipline and work ethics and everything. I coach Division Five teams. Greg, you'll be impressed of the order they can come up with and the bottles line up with their logos on the same side. Well, I mean, I should send you some pictures because I'm like a wow. And these kids are Division Five and they take pride of it. And every time I go after that, I don't have to say anything, right? Their bags are so like in order. And suddenly the coaches who are there is like, oh, I say, well, if you don't do that, how you want to get discipline on tactical discipline, tactical order, a strategy? You're going to teach any strategy if you have no order with the simple things of life. And I even went far and I told the kids, I say, you know how you want to look out there? You want to be unacceptable, acceptable, or exceptional. What exactly is your way of seeing the training here? You want to perform at what level? Are you that performance mentality, right? Are you just, you know, a recreational mindset or your performance mindset? So I think those little things are important. So for me, mentoring is about not empowering people or transforming people. It's about open the door for them to realize how powerful they are and how capable they are to start transmitting that knowledge, but with passion and you know what, come on, give me something. Because players are gonna see that, Greg. They feel you. And that's what a lot of time, you know, when I hear, oh, that coach, you know, that team sucks. They don't listen and all they say, oh, I don't think so. I think this problem or the challenge is somewhere else. And I think that's what I think coaches need to refine. We focus so much on what, Greg? Tactics, teaching the game, breaking down the game in 5 million pieces, deconstructing everything. And at the end of the day, I think the most critical part of it is to connect first. If we don't connect, how are we going to do that? So, yeah, I'm feeling that. I have a team now I just took from this club. And yeah, they had some issues over the past, but I love my team. I told you, I love my team. It's my team. We're going to die for it. We're going to do the best with my son. We're going to give you the best. Now, give me something back, too. And in the space of 2 weeks, I think we're seeing a change. They're coming to train now, everybody. And they're one of the moms told me yesterday, say, oh, my daughter is in heaven. She said, it's hard, but that's what we needed. Oh, well, good. We're working now. We have discipline. We and so on. So I think mentorship means that capacity of putting the time with the coaches and sure. Not again. I want to make a difference here. I'm not going to tell you what to do, Greg, but I want to show you how I do things. If I mentor you and how I interact and how I get this passion going, because at the end of the day, you're the coach, not me. But I want to show you that it's a beautiful way to go around this too. So, yeah,
Yeah,
that's how we do.
there's, yeah, that was great. There's a few things I want to pull out of there. One was like, it's not just what we teach as coaches, it's how we teach and how we connect with our people that matters. And then the second piece, which I read a good book, I think the guy's name was Patrick Bacon. It was like, he coached the worst hockey team in America, which was a little misleading. It was an okay team in Michigan. They truly weren't that bad. They had some access to talent, but they were in a really hard league, and his whole thing was creating pride in the discipline and how hard it was that they prepared. Like they had pride. Like it, I think I forget the name of the school, but it's like it's harder over here. Like that was the point of pride. And then when players tried to come, you know, they had to pass that bar, just kind of like you have with special forces. I know your son's very aware of that. I've got a few friends also in special forces here in the States. Yeah, we only do 5 days. Sorry, we don't do the full 10 like you guys do, but like there's a pride in knowing, okay, everyone else has been through hard things and can handle it. And there that brings the team together and acceptance and being able to hit a standard. If you could do it proper and in a good way. It's so powerful and so impactful, and just the discipline and all the life habits that you pick up from that, oh, just make you a better citizen and person.
Oh yeah, and I think you mentioned that the special forces, they become a brotherhood. And my fiance, we're brothers now for life, and they become a very tight unit in life and whatever they're doing in life. And also, you know, when I want to say, make a point here is coaching courses and licenses are pretty nasty, I will say sometimes. People go with fear, and I know because when I coach clinics, a lot of women or men come to me and say, John, I'm scared to hell. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm scared. And I say, listen, don't worry about it. I'm not here to judge you. I'm not here to criticize you. I'm here to help you, and I'm here to share with you stuff. So go from there. And that's, I think, one of the fallacies again of these coaching courses where you go and it's like, oh, you're good, you're not good, you're good, you're not good, oh, you're failed. No. Yeah, I'm aware that we need to learn or we need to follow certain things, but hey, open the door so I can learn. You see things different than I see, Greg. I'm pretty sure if I go observe you, I will learn. And if I listen to you coaching, I will learn and I will see different perspectives, different perceptions, different relationships between that coaching environment. So I think we need to correct many things in the coaching side of coaching coaches. And we don't have mentorship, by the way, anywhere. Very few organizations do good mentorship. If we say we do, mentorship is not going for a week somewhere with 300 coaches and give them a lot of paper, and that's it. Mentorship for me is like in the, like in the times of Michelangelo. You go to these beautiful schools of thought or painting or whatever, and they will spend time with the master or there for how many years, Greg? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years before they could leave and go create their own little academias or hotbeds of learning. And that's what mentorship is. Spend time with people. Here, I told the club here, hey, we need a mentorship program. We have 300 teams. Do you have one? And they're laughing. No, we don't have anything like that. I say, well, what are we waiting for? Well, trying to get a job too. But the point is, we need to get better at this mentorship, sort of like you say. I mean, it's one of the parts that are, I think, is critical to any club development and any club growth and progression into whatever the goal is. I mean, the goal is to get the kids playing, having fun, and retain them as long as we can, and so they can play for life too. Yeah, when they get older,
Yeah.
play until they're 99. Well, me, I'm going to play until 120, so I'm good. So I have a lot of
Yeah,
time.
120. Yeah. But I mean that's the end of the day. Like, you know, why did sports clubs start in the first place, right? It was about creating good citizens and having a good, healthy lifestyle, right? So I think that's a massive, and then the connection part as well. Like when you talk about why did people play sport, and that's a massive one. And that's something I try to have with all the groups that I have, is not just the players, the coaches, and also the parents. You know, there are all key stakeholders, and how can we get them working together and feeling connected? So, John, I got to say, this was an excellent conversation. I know you and I could probably go on for another few hours, but we got to wrap at some point, right? So, how can people find you or anything you want to plug? Feel free to talk about it real quick.
Well, they can reach me by email or my cell phone. I'm pretty old traditional guy, so I love to talk to people or even, you know, set up a meeting, a Skype meeting or Zoom meeting. Willing, I mean, with Dean, we're been creating we're a consulting firm basically for the last few years, but because he's PhD, we sort of put everything in hold. I've been writing for the last 20 years. I have basically designed so many games, and I think we have enough for two or three books. So, but because he's PhD, we got everything in hold. He got it finished. I hope he's done by next January, I hope. And once he's done, I think we can jump in our development sort of ideas and put them out there. And yeah, and you know, we've done some work with some teams out there, NHL in the past, and I hope, you know, I think it's a lot of room for what we do, because it's kind of the new trend in coaching now, is this approach, ecological dynamics and the nonlinear approach, using games as the principal tool and the players as the focus of how they can interact within those games. So yeah, pretty open. I will send you my contact and all that. And well, I think you have it. I don't know. I'll send it to you in case people ask or
Yeah,
on
wonderful.
your
And I'll put
phone.
it in the show notes for everyone, so it'll be nice and easy. But
Yeah.
no, thank you so much again for coming on. This is fantastic.
I love it.
Couldn't appreciate it more. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate that. Thank you, huh?
That concludes this week's episode. Thanks for joining us here at Hockey IQ. If you haven't already, take a quick moment to hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, and drop a review. If you want to be a great teammate, even recommend us to a friend. You can follow us at Hockey's Arsenal on Twitter and Instagram. Check out the website, hockeysarsenal.com, where you can subscribe to the weekly newsletter. You won't regret it. Catch your Buttes here next week for a brand new episode.